Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the 21st session of Fourth Lane Fridays. I'm Vanessa Hui, and I'm General Counsel and Vice President of Business Development at Fourth Lane. Thank you so much for tuning in today. So as most of you know, Fourth Lane is a Canadian multifamily office, and at the core of Fourth Lane is really a desire to service families and help them protect and grow their wealth, relationships, and legacy over multiple generations. This desire to protect and improve over multiple generations is also at the heart of today's discussion of renewable energy and sustainable investing. So COVID-19 has arguably created an even more compelling environment for investing in renewable energy. For one thing, the long-term prospects for traditional energy like oil and gas are looking increasingly dim. And today's incredibly low interest rate environment also means that, you know, there's really no better time to be investing in infrastructure. And personally, COVID-19 has really made me appreciate how vulnerable and interconnected our world is, and how we really have a duty to protect it, particularly underserved communities who are being disproportionately affected by things like a pandemic or climate change. And so with that in mind, today we're going to focus on the basics, the how and the why of sustainable investing and renewable energy. It's my pleasure to introduce our two speakers today, who both share a passion for building and supporting purpose-driven companies. So I'll start with Manish Nair. And Manish grew up in Windsor, Ontario, where his family had an auto parts manufacturing business. Recognizing that there was an opportunity in the traditional energy, in the renewable energy space, he shifted the family business from traditional industry to solar, which, you know, skipping past many accomplishments in a few years, we get to present day, which Manish is the founder and CEO of Oya Solar. And Oya Solar was founded in 2009 and has a pipeline of more than 100 solar projects across the US and Canada. And Manish's depth of knowledge in the sustainable investing space also extends beyond just solar energy. Through Oya Ventures, Manish also manages a portfolio of early stage companies in the clean tech and agrotech space. Thank you, Manish, for joining us. And now on to our second guest, Mehul Begat, who is joining us from New York City. Mehul is the founder of World Within Labs. World Within Labs is committed to building a world where we would be happy to be born at random. And they're doing this by investing capital and building capacity in underserved areas. And World Within's first company is actually a company called Zev, which equips entrepreneurs with zero emission food trucks and the tools to own and operate their own mobile food franchises, which allows, you know, the expansion of healthy food options into underserved communities. And Mehul is also a poet. It's not every day that we get to host a poet on Fourth Lane Fridays. And I asked him yesterday how his love for language and narratives, how it connects to World Within. And I loved his answer. He told me that what we can and cannot do in this world is largely informed by the stories we tell and what we believe. Thank you, Mehul, for being a guest today. And all right, it's now time for Ken and myself to grill you both. I'd also invite all attendees to feel free to ask your own questions by using the Q&A chat feature at the bottom of your screen. Only the panelists can see it, so don't be shy. And I'd like to kick things off by actually asking both of our guests to answer the same question. And this question is, why does climate change matter to you? You personally, and I guess I'll start with Manish because he's off mute.
Thanks, Vanessa, and thanks guys for hosting this great chat. I think climate change is important to me because I see the effects of it, and I'm, you know, curious by nature. And when I started Oya, I started to see the effects and really started to dive deep into understanding what was causing climate change and what the most impactful ways to reverse that tide would be. And I think now that I'm in the business and so focused on it. I'm actually more and more interested every day in the plethora of ways that we can actually get involved and in different sectors really start to turn back the clock in terms of some of the damage that we've done, thus far.
Yeah, I think for me, it's similar to Manish. We care about things when we can see and feel them. And, you know, my family's and my grandparents' story, I think, is something that I think about a lot with climate, because my grandfather grew up in what's now Pakistan, but at the time was India, and ended up spending a lot of his life in Delhi. And when you look at Delhi today, it's got a lot of air pollution caused predominantly by noxious emissions. And there are studies coming out saying that the average life expectancy in Delhi could be cut by somewhere between 7 to 10 years. My grandmother suffers from and deals with COPD. So both my grandparents moved to Canada and became Canadian citizens about a year and a half ago. And a lot of that decision was because of their health. It was, well, we don't know when you're getting older and what happens when something happens and we've got to take a 24-hour flight, 18-hour flight and spend a day trying to help you out and try to figure out how we can take care of you. And those decisions are increasingly impacting people, including my family. And we're looking at it from a position of privilege where my grandparents are able to visit my aunt and uncle and get a Canadian citizenship and be able to change where they're living. And then I think the other piece of it, which always has been in the back of my head, which is when my grandparents were growing up in 1950, India's population was 360 million or so. Today, India's population is almost 1.5 billion. And so when you look at it, we will have more and more people born on this planet. And those are the lives of future generations. Those are the lives of people that we have a responsibility to make sure that life works for them too, not just my grandparents, but our great-grandchildren. And so when I think about climate, I really think about what does it make, you know, when we think about sustainability, how do we actually make sure that life is not just worth living, but also possible? And those things are deeply personal to all of us.
Thank you. So I'm going to take it actually to from your personal stories to the market. So if you were a global allocator of capital or you're running a country, why should climate change matter to you, I guess? And then secondly, if you're a family that owns a business, you're a mom, you're a parent or an aunt or an uncle, why should this matter? Like, you know, at Fourth Lane, we're big believers in watch what people do, not what they say. And so we've spent a lot of time with the heads of global insurance companies who are actuaries and you know, monitor risk. And it's kind of alarming, some of the feedback we get from them. But maybe you could put in simple English, I know because both of you are quite active with institutional investors. Why does climate change even matter?
Question. You mentioned insurance companies. I think they're probably on the cutting edge of this. I think that if you really think about it, climate change affects our life in almost every way, whether we're consumers, whether we're businesses, whether we're governments, right? Pandemic, war, risk of flooding, global risk of your supply chain, the cost of your business, input costs into your product, into your service. I mean, all of these are affected by climate change and continue to grow in terms of risk as time goes on. We see it in our food supply, in terms of shortages. They're caused by droughts or fires. I think if you've been paying attention to the wildfires in California, I think even in Vancouver, the air pollution I think was some of the worst on record in the world in Vancouver, and that has dramatic and profound effects in a lot of ways, from your ability to deliver power, to not just businesses and critical infrastructure to residents, and especially and particularly, to the impacts are, I think, felt harder by the underserved and more disadvantaged communities, you know, in our country and globally. And I think it should matter to businesses because there's a tremendous financial opportunity, you know, both in terms of savings within their business, but also in terms of growth into new market sectors and into new business lines, because they can use their infrastructure and their wherewithal to really make an impact. And that, I think, matters for public companies and institutional investors, but I think maybe more so for families and multi-generational families.
It's interesting, Manish. Yesterday we spoke to the largest short seller in the United States in commercial real estate. And he may or may not be right, but what was interesting was his thesis. And his view was that, you know, a lot of these US commercial real estate players, even with central bank bailouts, have negative equity. But one of the things we talked about was actually the insurability of buildings. So for example, in Vancouver, we have heard murmurs of, you know, some of the insurance companies are like, look, we don't want to insure certain buildings for water damage, which in Canada, if you can't insure the building, you actually can't get a mortgage from a Canadian bank. So that is right. A really negative outcome for real estate investors. So it's in real estate for Canadian families, especially affluent families, is a huge asset class. And just to touch on the Indigenous community, so something I didn't realize, I had the privilege of participating with Watershed Partners. They had an Impact ESG conference really dedicated to Northern Canada, like the Arctic. And something I didn't quite appreciate was, you know, our most northerly communities, which are also underserviced, they're actually experiencing climate change at something like 3 times the rate at which we're seeing it in places like Toronto or New York or, you know, Chicago. And I should have known that, but I didn't quite get it, the magnitude of how much their lives are already changing. So, you know, I totally agree with you. And I guess the last thing I'll say is what Vanessa touched on in the introduction, which is we have the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years. So something we'll get into in the latter part of the call is, well, if you can basically borrow money for free, well, that all of a sudden makes building new supply chains and new ways of doing things significantly more affordable, but like you said, frankly, profitable. It's incredibly lucrative. But I'm going to stop there. And Mehul, what is Atlanta and New York thinking?
Well, I think it's too broad to summarize, but I think, you know, Manish, your point about looking at generational investment and thinking about the generations, I think is really important, because your original question was what makes climate change worth dealing with, right? And from a market standpoint or institutional standpoint, and if you think long-term enough, everything will impact you. And maybe for that Indigenous community in Northern Canada, it impacts them now, and it impacts them 3 times as worse as some of us are feeling it. But I think the story with climate is very similar to the story with, for example, the pandemic right now. I can speak from a US perspective. We spend a few $1 trillion on relief for the pandemic. There are estimates now coming out saying we could have lost $16 trillion in economic productivity, in GDP terms from the pandemic. And if you told people, well, you know, a pandemic's coming up, and in 2019 said to the CEO of Southwest Airlines, do you want to do something about it? Or you said to the CEO of a pension fund, do you want to do something about it? Or you said to a government official, do you want to do something about it? All of them would say, we want to invest some money now to protect ourselves in 2020 and not lose $16 trillion worth of value from a market standpoint. The scary and morally urgent thing about climate to me is we know it's coming, right? Like, we know there's a lot of changes that are happening today about climate. We know the costs, if you want to look at it from a market and quantifiable perspective, are huge. And yet there's a lack of action at the rate that we need to invest in the outcomes we need in the future. And so it's a place where, you know, the gap is closing in the sense that more and more people are, I think, internalizing this message. But it's one of those areas where I look at it and say, we have often the technology, we have the wealth and resources as a society. What we need is investment in these areas, building capacity in the places that need it, and political will, frankly, in a lot of places to help organize and drive a lot of that.
And so maybe we can touch on that political will. So, you know, there's only really 2 things the Democrats and Republicans agree on, right? It's one is infrastructure spend, which is likely going to be green. You know, interestingly, even in the US and traditional sale, you've seen two of the best shale companies actually sell in the last month at very low multiples. And these are smart CEOs. So that, you know, traditional energy, that sends an incredible price signal. You're selling in the middle of COVID, the lowest cost producing assets in traditional shale at a depressed multiple. So which tells you the transition is happening. But, you know, I just lost my train of thought there. Mihail, what was your last comment? So a political will. Sorry, yeah. The two things they agree on. One is antitrust legislation, and the second thing is infrastructure spend. Could you touch on, from a U.S. perspective, it looks like Biden will win, but it's still very close. Irrespective, you know, the market hasn't waited for Trump's policies. Like, the renewable sector is rocking and rolling. What do you think is the catalyst to wake up the average family or the average CEO or CFO? And I'll just share one tidbit with you. There's a really good article in the CFO Weekly magazine last week that it's almost like CFOs have to have a view on climate change risks. Before it was kind of optional, but what do you think is the catalyst to wake people up? Like, not just investors, but owners of businesses. Like, what will it take to wake people up?
Boy, if I knew that answer, I would be in a different place. But I think to some extent, it is committed moral leadership among a small number of people, right? You can't expect everyone to do everything voluntarily, but there will be people like the people on this call who go in and say, I really want to do something about climate. I'm building a company, I'm allocating capital, I'm doing whatever I do in my day-to-day job to do something about it. But I do think there is a missing sense of leadership on a national level in a lot of places, particularly like in the US. I completely agree with you. We need infrastructure spending, and it's a great opportunity to create green infrastructure spending where we're actually tackling climate, we're creating green collar jobs, which we know often can't be outsourced, right? You need people to work on actually building and retrofitting and upfitting solar. That's not gonna be outsourced. And we know those jobs will be around for 15, 20, 25 years. So it's not just a, you know, great idea to tackle climate. There's a lot of ways that it's a great idea to actually be politically popular, to be economically good. And I think there's a lot of people who recognize that. And then, you know, the last piece I'll touch on is maybe even framing the issue in a different way. There's a political will challenge. One of the people I deeply admire in the climate space, Saul Griffith, talks about it from a financial lens. And he has a great book out called Rewiring America. And his basic thesis is a lot of the challenges that we've addressed as societies have actually been financial instruments. For example, when you look at the 50s and 60s, before then, people couldn't own a home. You had to be really, really wealthy to buy a home because you couldn't get a mortgage. And so we invented the FHA loan. And the idea of climate and retrofitting climate in the United States, he says, is, well, we need what he's calculated out to be about $40,000 of investment per home so that they can plug into the new grid, so that they can actually be able to be power generators rather than sucking out power from the electric grid. And there's all sorts of conversions that would be necessary. He says, if we've got low interest rates, why don't we finance them? Why don't we create a national policy where we're actually doing massive industrial investment to get the infrastructure built so that all these innovative companies can now then have these great opportunities to create jobs and do what they do well, which is innovation and risk-taking. And so I think it'll happen. It's a question of when, not if.
So so what you're saying then is that how I look at it as an investor is things are so bad. When 80% of the world's bonds have negative yields on them, that tells you how bad things are. But frankly, as an infrastructure investment, like that's like Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas. Like you could not ask for a better setup. And like you said, $40,000 a home is actually not a big deal. And if you're like the government of Singapore, Audi or Norges or Ontario Teachers, you need returns. So those large pools of capital from the pension plans and the life insurance companies who have to asset liability match, they're definitely showing up to the party. And I think we've all seen that the Bank of England, the central bank governor, Mark Carney, most recently joined Brookfield. So I think that sends an incredible price signal. But Manish, maybe we can switch to you and drill down a little here on the economics, right? You've built a top five business in North America. I mean, your cost of debt has plummeted. Your revenues are increasing. You've got 60 people in Toronto. Your business is doing really, really well. And so when you think about the next 3-4 years, what excites you as a business owner? And then also, frankly, building a cross-border business based out of Canada, what frustrates you? What could we as a nation do better and unlocking real potential.
Yeah, maybe I'll answer the last question first, the second question first. I think it is frustrating because we were founded here in Canada, you know, because of good, what I think was good government policy. Some may have thought that it was slightly wasteful government policy at the provincial level with the Green Energy Act and the feed-in tariff program. And I think that the example that we've been able to show in ourselves is a testament to good policy, in that we haven't developed or constructed a solar project in Ontario in over 5 years. But our business and our employee headcount has doubled in size over that time period. And we've used, you know, everything that we built and the infrastructure that we built to become effectively an export company, right? In the sense that we're exporting our knowledge and the IP that we gained here into other markets. And so I think that, you know, from a policy perspective, we as Canadians need to do a better job understanding the IP we have in this country, you know, not just in the renewable space, but in energy and natural resources more broadly, because I think as part of this transition that's about to happen, we have a lot to offer. But I think that to your first point, what was your first question again? Just remind me.
Just like what excites you? I mean, if you think about the next 5 years, I mean, you know, you can't predict a Biden or Trump victory, but what you do know is the secular tailwinds are very positive. What gets you? I mean, look, your business, I suspect if you wanted to sell it tomorrow, there'd be 10 PE buyers to buy your business. Right. But obviously you're not a seller. So what excites you as a business person in the next 5 years? You're like, wow, this is going to be really cool.
Yeah, I think what excites me is that, you know, despite what we hear in the news that you know, most Republicans are climate deniers, what excites me about the U.S. in general, which is where the bulk of our market is today, is that I think that, and to Mail's point, I think people are recognizing that there's an opportunity here. So we of course have, you know, the far left Democrats that everyone calls socialist and the Green New Deal ideas. But I think we see the exact same thing on the far, far right amongst the libertarians. And what we're seeing in the US is farmers that are traditionally more Republican leaning are actually embracing solar in a big way because they see the benefits to them personally, because it's helping them save the family farm. It's helping them diversify. It's helping them keep the farm in their family, that multi-generational farm. And that gets me excited because it makes me feel that despite what we hear at the national level, and despite this kind of disjointed policy framework that we really need to figure out a way to solve, I think that in general, we see this really great roadmap, which is not so clear today, but I think the runway is there. And, you know, we expect growth in renewables, you know, more broadly, even beyond solar and community solar, I think to be probably one of the highest growth industries in the US for the next 20 years.
Yeah, so before I hand it over to Vanessa, because she's got a great treasure trove of community specific questions, I'm gonna ask you one last macro question. And this is from the audience is, and I think I may know the answer, but is the total environmental footprint of solar power smaller or bigger than the equivalent amount of energy produced with oil or natural gas? How do you think about that? And is it just an issue of transition? So,
yeah, it's actually much smaller. There's a lot of debate out there, but we've done some research and I want to say that it's an order of magnitude less. Even if you think about hydropower, you would actually not recognize that the environmental footprint for solar is less even than hydropower, something that we consider to be clean, because there's obviously an impact to the environment. There's you know, when we build dams in order to harness that hydropower energy, but there's actually an ongoing negative environmental impact in terms of sediment, and freshwater supply, and impact to plant and animal life. And so I would say that it's something on the order of magnitude of 10 to 20 times less than oil and gas.
Interesting. So I guess it's always been a question of, do you have low enough interest rates to build the infrastructure? Because you got to push the cost curve down, right? And I just think, I've never seen anything like this in my career, like literally with lowest interest rates in 5,000 years. I mean, you can push the cost curve down pretty quickly, even with we almost don't even need political will, like the market will drive this, like you said, the farmers. Now, Vanessa, let's drill into communities.
You know what? I want to ask one more question to Manish, actually, and then Mehul, I promise we won't forget about you. For the people on the call that are just brand new to renewable energy, brand new to solar, can you just explain, Manish, what is the difference between community solar and when we think of traditional solar projects?
Sure.
Just back to the basics.
So when we think about solar, we typically think about the large farms, utility scale farms, that might be hundreds of acres, or we think about rooftop solar, which a homeowner would buy to power a portion of their home's electricity use. And what we actually realize is a few things. Number one, there's probably 120 to 130 million households in the US. Only half of those homes, from a pure technical perspective, would qualify to actually have a solar system installed on their roof. When you think about how many of those homeowners actually have either the financial means or the financial credit to purchase an expensive residential solar system, you know, that number cuts almost in half again. And so when we think about the actual cost to acquire, you know, to market, to educate those homeowners, and the waste in trying to find those folks that we can match, that meet all that criteria, it doesn't really help us, you know, to Ken, to your point, you know, create the framework and the financial product in a way that can really, really scale. And a couple of people have done it well, but, you know, Tesla, Sunrun, but it's expensive. I mean, they had to spend a lot of capital to get to where they are. Where community solar allows developers like us to basically build a solar project without first having our customer, you know, a Google, a Facebook, you know, a cement company as our customer for that power. And then basically sell the power to hundreds of people in the community. And so what that allows the homeowner to do is not to have to think about their credit score, you know, where they're going to put it on the roof, what they're going to choose not to buy instead, because now, you know, to Mehul, to your point, we've created a financial instrument. You know, we allow that residential homeowner, that business, that municipality, that affordable housing provider, or that lower moderate income resident to now buy that power from me today and save 10, 15, 20% on their electricity bill from day one without a long-term commitment. And so we effectively have created a renewable utility model. And that's really what community solar is.
So it's interesting that renewable utility model, community solar, something that really jumps out at me is, you know, when I was a tech banker back in the Valley 20 years ago, when the internet was being birthed, you know, at the time people forgot, like the reason it was the US Department of Defense who invented the internet, and they invented it because they were worried about the Russians striking Washington and Washington not being able to talk to other centers. So it was really a security risk that drove the spend to build the internet. And one of the things that we talk about on our investment committee, we think the market doesn't talk enough about cybersecurity. We think cybersecurity is a huge threat. And when we talked to senior defense officials around the world, they said, look, the biggest defense against an attack is actually decentralizing the electricity grid. Decentralized power, that's exactly what why we invented the internet, right? So it's almost in a way, yes, there's a huge community element to it, but part of community is resilience. And cybersecurity is a real issue, which we don't think the market yet talks enough about, but we think in the next 5 years, it will start to talk about it. But anyways, with that observation, I'm going to turn it over to Vanessa. And Mehul, I think you wanted to share a thought before we went over to the community focus.
No, keep going.
All right, Vanessa, over to you.
Well, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about Zev and explain to us just how Zev, to me, it's a great case study. It's an example of what decisions we can make and, you know, what companies we can build to do our part in this obviously massive issue that we have at, in front of us. So can you talk to us about the impact that Zev has had on local communities?
Yeah. What is Zev and why are food trucks important in New York City? And how are you empowering equity ownership and playing your part in decarbonization? And can you please also touch on the quality of executives you're attracting for this business? Because that I think is staggering.
Yeah, sure. So Zev is just to introduce the company, Zev is tackling the transportation industry challenges, transportation and food logistics in New York City, and specifically around food trucks. In New York City, there are about 5,100 licensed food trucks. And what a lot of people know about them is they walk by them, they eat from them, they probably smell them because they're generally diesel powered. And what they may not know is the regulations on generators and food trucks have not kept up with the emissions regulations that have actually regulated the passenger car market. And so a lot of the food trucks, nearly all of them on the streets in New York City are technically illegal. They don't meet any standard imposed by the city, the state, or the federal government. But everyone knows that the policies are broken. And so they just kind of run their food truck and they sell their halal guys or whatever they're selling. And you know, the company Zev was founded by Max Crespo, who ran his own pizza truck. And I'll tell you, you know, you talk about quality of executives and some of the folks, you know, they've got great resumes, Ken, but someone like Max is someone who just, he's great because of the hustle he has, because the company he started after working in nightclubs was selling pizza out of a food truck in New York City. And if you tell me what's the hardest business to do in the world, it's probably selling pizza out of a food truck in the hardest city in the world to sell food out of. And he said, my business model was selling pizza to drunk people. And it turns out drunk people really don't care how their pizza tastes. And so he ended up creating a great company. And doing this was like, man, my food truck's actually polluting a lot. And I wonder if I could do something different. And long story short, couldn't find anything on the market. Couldn't find any alternative that was cost effective and affordable, and converts all of his own fleet for his brand, pizza brand, Neapolitan Express, into a zero emission fleet. And they're using various different sources of energy that are renewably produced. And so with Zev, what we're doing is we're taking that technology and allowing other people across the entire food industry to be able to use it. We're democratizing access to it, which means that instead of doing a $2 million build out of a brick and mortar store like your Starbucks in New York City, you're suddenly dropping the cost to $300,000-$400,000 to open a mobile restaurant in New York City or a mobile cafe or a mobile coffee shop in the city. You're doing it with a zero emission footprint, which is from all the way from generation of the food that we're using in the compost, all the way to what the truck is doing on the road. And most importantly, the numbers are staggering. So when you put a Tesla on the road, you take effectively one gas powered car off the road. If you buy a Tesla instead of a traditional passenger car, when you take one Zev mobile vending unit and you put it on the road, you take 300 passenger cars off the road, because what we're replacing is so bad for the environment. And so the scale of what we can do just by focusing in on the food truck market as our beachhead market is really, really remarkable. And the last thing I would say is, where do Teslas drive? They typically drive in wealthy upper income areas. Where do food trucks and refrigerated vehicles, where are they parked? Where do they idle? Where do they pollute the most? It's not just greenhouse gas emissions. It's also the air pollutants and NOx that actually hinders health outcomes. And so if we really want to make a difference, and I know you want to talk about underserved communities, we've got to figure out how do we build companies and scale technologies that are not just solving the macro problem, but are also disproportionately helping the communities that need it the most. That's what excited me about Zev. And the people that have kind of come together around this has been, you know, our investment team, Max, who really knew the pizza business and has known hospitality, Kevin Ryan, who built Business Insider and MongoDB and Zola. And so it's really become this big effort to figure out how do we scale this and really electrify the trucking industry across the United States. So it's really, really exciting. But the reality is we also need 100 more of these kinds of companies. We need 1,000 more of companies like this that are tackling really big problems from different angles, because there's both the opportunity to do it from the, in the market, and there's also the need to do it. You know, it's inevitable that we're going to have to solve a lot of these problems.
So basically, like for example, if you take these trucks, they go up to say Harlem or, you know, Yonkers or wherever they go, Queens, they're now going to pollute their neighborhoods less, right? Those underserviced communities.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the total addressable market is? Like how big of a deal? Like I know, for example, in India or China, there are other parts where food trucks are like a huge part of urban centers. What do you estimate is like the total addressable market?
You know, it's really hard to, I should probably know this number, but it's really hard to estimate. But I'll give you a bottom-up example, right? So 5,100 trucks in New York is our initial kind of market. We're doing trucks and carts. And just to give you a sense of what makes it successful is also the operator. So we have a cart that was launched by a brand named Blank Street. You probably haven't heard of it because they didn't exist 6 months ago. They'd never run a coffee brand before. They had never operated a food cart before. They're now on an electric zero emission food cart in Williamsburg during COVID with one employee in 50 square feet. And they're making around $30,000 a month in top line revenue out of one cart and 50 square feet. And they're now scaling their carts to about 11 carts across the city. So what our North Star is as a company is going after electrifying trucks, you know, really scaling up the sustainable energy transition. But what makes it successful in the short run is making sure the individual operators are profitable and successful on a zero emission platform. That's what makes the economy work.
Profits and purpose.
And that's what makes it scale. Because if the operator doesn't make money, or it costs them three times as much to buy their zero emission truck, they're not gonna do it. It doesn't make sense for them. And so that's what's really powered the business. And to go back to your last question about kind of size, you know, LA County will probably be our second market. There are 17,000 food trucks there. If we just replace those 17,000 food trucks on the food trucking side, that's the equivalent of removing emissions from 5.1 million passenger cars, which is a magnitude larger, over 10 times larger than what Tesla's produced in its entire lifespan, right? The scale of what this could be, and that's just food, you know, that's just the food trucks. Next is refrigerated vehicles, right? Which are in the number in the millions in the US alone. So, you know, it's really hard for me to quantify the size. We'll kind of see it as we scale it. But I think even looking at the narrow food trucking market is a place where change is desperately needed. And it's exciting because I think it really holds a lot of the values I think about with sustainability, which is it's not just about the planet, though it is about the planet. It's about all the pieces of the company and making sure they're sustainable, from how you're thinking about your team, to how you're thinking about workers and treating them well, to how you're thinking about the long-term financial stability and making sure that it's just the underlying way of doing business. Like you're talking about, a CFO has to have an opinion on sustainability. It's because it's part of the job. It's part of everyone's job. It's your job as a citizen. So like, how can we figure that out in thinking about that in the DNA of a company?
It's interesting, you know, like when we've learned during our careers on Wall Street, you need two things to be successful, right? You need, first of all, you need an evidence-based investment process, facts. The second thing is you have to be able to storytell, because if you have only the facts and you can't storytell, you don't resonate with people, and then there's no political will. So for example, food trucks, like your storytelling, that's something everybody understands. Like every municipal voter in New York City will understand what a food truck is. And it's really that, I think the penny drops, and then they think about, like you said, refrigerated trucks, because they're in the millions. Like cold storage is a massive global business. Actually, one of our good friends of the firm did one of the world's largest IPO in that sector. So I'll actually follow up with him on what he thinks, because they have huge US and Chinese assets. But the storytelling is important. So your poetry adds value, not just your business skills. But back to you, Vanessa.
Yeah, I noticed that someone has their hand up. I just want to remind people that the Q&A button is in the middle. And you can type in your question there.
It's anonymous.
I don't know if the hand up is accidental or you want to ask a question. So this question, it can be for whoever wants to answer it, but you know, I think traditionally there's been a sense that impact and returns are, you know, at a dichotomy of each other. I think, you know, thankfully that's changing, and perceptions are changing, but I wanted someone to speak to how one can evaluate expected returns when looking at different impact investment opportunities.
Yeah, and that's a great question, Vanessa. And Mehul, maybe you could use, I mean, you're obviously raising your own impact fund and you have seen your experience at a family office, single family office. Maybe you could just give us some investment metrics like you know, Zephy, like the food trucks. Like if we're putting in $10 million today, if we're right, how much money do we make in 3 to 5 years? What's the probability? And if we're wrong, how much do we lose? And, you know, I guess I'll give you your competition. So when we look at private equity deals around the world or infrastructure, they're anywhere from, you know, call it 2 times to 5 times return of cap, multiple of capital over a 5 year period. Just depends on the asset class. So are you competitive with that? And how do you think about the odds as an investor?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is we don't. What we're looking at is only things that are above market returns. There's no concession. And we look at impact as the underlying driver of the business. I was talking to someone a couple of weeks ago, and this isn't a new concept, but the way he put it was really striking to me. He says, does it pass the evil CEO test? And I said, what do you mean? And he goes, well, if you just replaced the CEO and thought of the most evil CEO in the world you can think of, and you put them in the driver's seat, would the company still do good? Would the company still do maximum amount of good in the world? And I was like, yeah, like it would, right? Like the way you're doing good is the way you're making money in this company. There's no way to mess that up, right? There's no way to do that, right? And so the design of the company, it's not impact as like a give back program or as just a sheen or a PR thing. It's encoded in the DNA of the company. It's in the aluminum fabrication of the truck, right? It's in the fuel that you're putting into the truck or the battery that you're manufacturing. It's in each piece and in every part of every person that's part of the team, right? And so that, to me, there's no barrier between an impactful company and an unprofitable one in that sense. Like, it's not about some sort of concession. It's about, are you designing it in a way that's really around a particular problem? And what's really exciting about climate is every problem has a potential to make a really positive impact if you can solve it. If you can figure out how to make solid state batteries and figure out how to increase battery storage by 2 or 3 times and make it cheaper, that's really deeply impactful. You'll make a lot of money and you'll change the world. If you can figure out how to electrify trucks and make them affordable and sustainable, you will make money and you will change the world, right? I mean, all of it, if you figure out how to, you know, scale community solar across North America and be a top 5 company, like Manish's already figured out, like, you know, you're changing the world, right? And it's in the design of the company itself. And, you know, the quantitative aspect you were asking, Ken, like, you know, since we're so early stage, you know, we're looking at 10 to 20X returns and all of the companies, and that's the only, you know, we take such concentrated bets that anything less than that is not a success.
Love it. So go big or go home. So interesting. I have to give Mehul a shout out here. He introduced us to the chairman of a Canadian company actually called Lufa Farms, which it's American venture capitalist partnering with Canadians. But they said, what if we could create precision agriculture, farm to table, fully vertically integrated? Would it work? And they chose Montreal, Canada as their petri dish. And they now feed 2.5% of the entire population of Montreal, which is not a small city. They do an incredible amount of revenue, and they're actually very EBITDA positive, i.e. they make money. And so anyways, it's kind of neat because you look at that business, like if somebody showed me what their revenues and EBITDA and their growth was, and I didn't know what they did, I would beg to be a shareholder in that business, like beg. Right.
Yeah. It's a great example, Ken, because it's like that's a company that is just getting started, right? Montreal is a $1 billion revenue market up for the opportunity for them. And so is every city, every urban area where they can produce. And what it took was, you know, a pretty young guy, the CEO of the company, he's in his 20s, and he said, I'm just going to do this, right? I'm just going to do this. And, you know, I'm going to figure out how to make it sustainable and profitable at the same time. And sometimes you really need those people who have an underlying faith and belief in something, because that's what drives the business forward. Well, Manish, I know you had a point you were going to hear.
Yeah, what was genius is about Lufa Farms is, you know, when I talked to the chairman, I said, well, you know, you're going to do all this. You're going to gentrify neighborhoods. You're going to make all these commercial real estate guys rich. He goes, no, we're not. We're acquiring 5 million square feet. I said, bingo. finally the impact community, the artists, like the people who actually build the communities, I go, you finally figured out how the economic value chain works. And he goes, nope, we're going to own our own real estate. But with that, Manish, maybe, yeah, like Mehul just said, like, you've built a top five North American business. Like you've figured it out. And, you know, you don't need external capital, but if say somebody wanted to put $100 million or $5 million or whatever into the sector, you know, if you're not accepting, because we would like to be shareholders in your business too, but if you're not accepting new shareholders, where should people be putting capital to work? Should we just put it in, you know, in different funds, or which part of the capital stack excites you the most, or by vertical?
Well, which part of the capital stack? For sure, equity. And which vertical? I would say community solar storage would be my top two bets, and technology related to the new electrical grid, the new distribution structure that we're going to have to create in order to manage all of this new distributed generation, and including things like, you know, maybe one day even Mehul's electric trucks, maybe they're going to be considered peak power supplies when they're parked, you know, somewhere in New York City, providing on-demand spinning reserve power, you know, using software to leverage, you know, thousands of trucks, and that things like that are already happening. The market opportunity, I think, for electrification just in the U.S. is something like 300 gigawatts of new generation to support just the transportation sector, and, you know, getting rid of things like using fuel oil heating in states like Massachusetts. So, you know, community solar is expected to be maybe 30% of that market by 2030, 2035. So there's just a huge growth opportunity in all things that are ancillary to that. I mean, we're gonna have so many different battery technologies that are going to come to market over the next 3 to 5 years. I think you probably saw Elon Musk just this week say that he's gonna cut the price of storage in half. And he said something that I thought was interesting. He said, you know, we're a company of startups, right? And I think that's true is something that, you know, when Mehul was speaking, I thought, you know, it really comes down to the founder saying, I know that there's something here. I know that this is a profitable opportunity that can secondly do good, but not really have an exact way to put their finger on it and say, how much impact is this going to have? And then you see what the network effects are 1 year later, 2 years later, 3 years later, and then you're able to start measuring. And I think that that's really what we're in the middle of seeing right now.
So I'll share one anecdote with you. So back in 2001, there was at the time, a relatively small data storage company called EMC. And so we're doing like their first large equity raise. And I remember us being in the room and saying, what is this data storage stuff? Like this is only 2001. So I worked on that. And I was like, I guess it makes sense. One day we're going to need like to store data. In any event, that business was sold for $67 billion to Dell Computers in 2015. And I actually haven't done the mark to market, but I'm sure Dell's done quite well with that acquisition. So when you talk about data and storage, it just kind of triggers to me like how gargantuan the potential returns could be. But we have a couple of really good questions from the floor. I'll do the first one. Maybe, you know, Vanessa, you can hit on the second one. So here's somebody who wants concessionary returns. They said, okay, well, how do we convince people in our country and wealthy institutional investors to invest in projects that may have less financial returns, but potentially greater social returns, right? So it's something in between. There's philanthropy, and then there's what you're saying, profits and purpose, and there's that in between. How do you wrestle with that? And is it really like to get people to cross the finish line to deploy capital? Is it just come down to storytelling? And I guess Mehul, you've had a lot of experience with this because you've been both raising capital, but you've also been the family office investing. So maybe you can take a shot at that one, and then we'll give Manish the next hard question.
Manish, I feel like you should get all the hard questions.
Thanks.
I do think stories are at the core of it. I mean, I could only speak to, I clearly was not listening to Vanessa's arguments about turning off our volume. I can only speak to the way that we have done things. And the way that we have done things is about community. At the end of the day, what makes Lufa Farms, like you said, Ken, successful, or what makes Zev potentially successful, is the people that are involved. And if you're gonna take an operating approach like we do, or if you're gonna take an approach where you really deeply care about the impact something's gonna have, you cannot ignore the fact that there are people that are gonna either make it successful or not. And I think when you look at it that way, you start to evaluate every potential deal or opportunity differently. Because frankly, when you're investing in a pre-seed or seed company, or even a Series A company, the numbers don't mean anything. They really don't. Because you, like Manish, you made a great point. You don't know exactly the way the dots are gonna connect, right? Like it's completely arbitrary, but you do know that there's an impulse and that there's an ambition and there's a hunger for something that could be changed there. And maybe there's an insight. So I think the story and the person is deeply powerful.
Okay, so got it. So it's interesting. One of the world's largest growth investors, Bailey Gifford, which is Tesla's second largest shareholder, you know, was one of the anchor orders for Amazon's IPO. And actually Fourth Lane, we're partners with them. And they said the exact same thing. They said, it's the total addressable market and the visionary and the culture. Those are the three things they look at. So it sounds like in that middle ground where there's potentially less financial returns, but significantly more greater social returns, it's really the same investment criteria. So the people, it's the people. Very cool. Vanessa, another question from the floor.
It's your turn. So this question is, the person who took this question says, I believe that currently only 3% of the world's energy comes from solar and wind, which may include hydroelectric. What is your estimate of how long it will take for renewable energy to eclipse traditional energy sources?
In terms of total generation, I think for the first time in the last 6 to 12 months, we've seen that the price of electricity from solar and wind is lower than the price from coal plants. And, you know, I think that we are very, very close. I believe at the end of 2019, over half of all new generation globally was wind and solar. So at this point, it's just a matter of how fast and exponential the closures of coal plants first, and then other, you know, combined cycle gas plants, et cetera, will start to happen. And then coupling that with how fast storage technologies will really become part of every new renewables deployment. So, you know, we are well on the path to a renewable future. It makes financial sense almost everywhere in the world right now. It's just a matter of time. We've already seen that most of the new generation deployed globally is renewables. So at this point, we're probably 10 years, 15 years away from.
Yeah, so I'll share two observations. One is we did a lot of work on Saudi Arabia's IPO for the oil company called Aramco. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting, Aramco's like, look, because they're gonna impact, right? Like how quickly we adopt renewables. And, you know, I think the Russians and the Saudis get it. There's a reason why they did the price war during COVID. They're the lowest cost marginal producers in the world. And they understand that whether it's 15 years or it's 20 years, there's a wind down trade. And they're very wisely going to take more market share because they know they can't. Unfortunately, the cartel is very difficult. And you're seeing that in the oil markets today. Having said all of that, I actually think when we look at the traditional energy sector, we do see some value, but less value than you'd think. Because you have to look, remember, businesses that have only 15 or 20 years left, there's just not a lot of terminal value or zero in some cases. Something I want to share with our community is next week, you know, if you really kind of take a step back, what Manish and Mehul have very generously shared with us, it's community building, but it's also frankly commercializing science. It's solving big problems with science. And next week on Fourth Lane Friday, we're going to have our former Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, who spent 10 years in government in Canada. He's the youngest G7 leader. He wrote a really good op-ed a few weeks ago on commercializing science, because it's critical, not just for the world, but it's also critical for Canada. As we, you know, we're not going to transition from, you know, natural resources overnight. I think that is a 15, 20 year period. Having said that, we do need to put the infrastructure in place. And joining him is a really interesting trio. So Suzanne Fletcher and her partner, Dakin Sloss, they built, they have a VC fund called Primrose Labs in Palo Alto. And Suzanne for many years ran Stanford's incubator. So Suzanne was looking at 200 deals a year. And she is a huge fan of Waterloo in Canada. You know, she says, look, your country is already very powerful, but there's a lot more business to do. And her partner, Dakin Sloss, he's a little boring. He's only invented the world's first, he helped found OpenGov, which is like, it's the government tech platform to make governments more efficient. God bless him. Also joining us is Dr. Sherry Vanstone. So her and her husband, Scott Vanstone, Scott was actually a professor at Waterloo doing math and cryptology back in the 80s and 90s. And he literally, they took like their true millhouses, right? They said, wait a minute, people need security. So they took cryptology from literally from University of Waterloo, and they built a company called Certicom, and they built the security moat for BlackBerry. So BlackBerry became great for several reasons, but one of the key things is they used to have the best security moat in the world, right? Before good came along. In any event, Sherry and her husband built that business, and then they went a step further, and they actually built the security software for, I believe, and I'll confirm this, but for every electric vehicle producer in the world. So they could see the EV sector ahead of the market. And so that's what we try to focus on at Fourth Lane, is anticipating anticipation. You know, in terms of closing remarks, you know, if you had to deliver, you know, from a personal perspective, if somebody wanted to get smarter on community solar or just community investing, period, is there a book or a resource or an organization? So we're putting you on the spot here. How can they learn more? How can they get more involved? Give us something actionable.
Well, first of all, if anybody's really interested, they can contact, I'm sure, myself or Mayho directly. Absolutely. In our industry, we do have a trade organization, the Coalition for Community Solar Access, which has a lot of resources online. Obviously, the U.S. National Trade Association, SEIA.org, has also a lot of information for folks to really understand what's going on in the market. But again, reach out to myself anytime, mail anytime. We'd be happy to point you to some more specific resources.
Right. And if you ever sell some stock, you make sure you talk to Fourth Lane first. We like 5 and 10 baggers. Mayho, over to you.
Definitely reach out to us if you want to talk. But in terms of resources, I think there's two books specifically, and they're both really easy reads. One I mentioned earlier, Rewiring America, which I think is open source. You can download a PDF online
for free.
And it does a great job of, Ken, what you were talking about, like, what does it take to build the infrastructure? And like, what does that look like, whether it's through markets, through government, or a combination? And then the other book, which is available as well, is called Project Drawdown. And it was put together by a lot of great climate scientists across the world, and does a really good job of outlining, you know, all the different pieces of science we have and where they are in terms of commercialization. What does it take to figure out these? What does it take? What would the impact be if we planted a bunch of trees, right? And tries to lay them into a bigger picture, which if you're just looking at it and going, well, climate's a huge thing. Like, where do I want to focus on? What do I want to look at? That is a great primer on that topic.
Awesome. Thank you so much. This was like, I think Vanessa and I and the community learned a lot today. And please sell us stock in your businesses.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
Thanks so much, Ken and Vanessa.
Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye.